What happens when you take a designer's mindset of prototyping and apply it to your actual life? This is the question that I got to discuss with Professor Bill Burnett, who co-founded the Life Design Laboratory at Stanford University. When we look at our lives as a work in progress and realize that there's so much we can control with self-reflection and the right mindset, then we can actually begin to design our lives how we want them to look. This was an incredible conversation. So be prepared to be entertained and learn how you can start designing your life today.
Hello, everyone. I am extremely excited today. We have Professor Bill Burnett, who is the Executive Director of the Design Program at Stanford University. He directs both the undergraduate and the graduate programs, and Bill has worked professionally on a wide variety of projects, ranging from award-winning Apple PowerBooks to the original Hasbro Star Wars action figures. He is the co-founder of the Life Design Lab at Stanford University, teaching a course that helps you figure out what you want to grow into next as your life unfolds. He's the co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Designing Your Life, How to Build a Well-Lived, Joyful Life, as well as a phenomenal TED speaker. We are very excited to have you with us here today. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Wonderful. Now, for some of our audience who has absolutely no idea what any of that means that I just said, can you tell them a bit about yourself?
Well, sure. I've been a designer my whole career. I came to Stanford. I grew up in the Boston area, but when I had a chance to get as far away from my parents as possible for college, I took it and ended up at Stanford. And we have a really unique program here in design, which it's not, when most people hear about design, they think about graphic design or industrial design, one of the craft design jobs. And those are fantastic. I mean, they're incredibly talented people who do that stuff. We've always taught a different kind of design. We're sort of in the engineering school, and we combine engineering and psychology and anthropology to really understand human needs. Originally, we called it human-centered design, and now we call it design thinking. So I got educated in that. I worked at places like Apple and what's now Hasbro, working on Star Wars toys. But I've always been interested in the interesting problem of, what do you want to be when you grow up, or what do you want to do next? How do you figure that stuff out? And it seemed to me like that was really just another design problem. You're trying to invent a future that doesn't exist. That's what designers do. We invent the PowerBooks when they didn't exist, and they invented the iPhone and it never existed. So trying to figure out how to create these futures that are compelling and interesting and fun to live in seemed like a design problem. And my buddy Dave Evans, who's the co-author of the book and co-founder of the lab, was doing a class over at Berkeley, talking about vocation and how do you find what you want to do with your life. He and I got together and started chatting, and pretty soon that turned into a couple of prototypes of some classes, and that just kind of snowballed into this whole designing your life thing. We now teach designing your life to seniors and juniors. We teach designing your Stanford to the freshmen and sophomores, so that they don't do. We always say, don't do Stanford like you did high school. You're not trying to get in anymore. You're here, right? Mm-hmm. We teach a class called Designing Professionals to the PhD students who are going to exit and figure out what their lives are like. So it's really been kind of a fun adventure. And then all that turned into the book because everybody kept saying, oh, that sounds like a cool class. Can I take it? And we're like, well, not really, unless you come to Stanford. And we were tired of saying no to people all the time. So Dave and I put the book together.
And how long has this process been in the works?
We've been teaching the class now in its various forms for over 7 years, almost 8 years now. And again, it started out just like we do with all designs, as a small prototype, 6 students, 2 nights for about 4 hours. And the end of the second night, it was a Wednesday, Thursday. We just had a couple of 3 or 4 ideas for little exercises that might be useful. At the end of that first prototype, the students refused to leave. They said, no, you don't understand. There's no place to have this conversation. This is super important to us. They stayed till midnight, just generating more ideas about how to be helpful, in solving this problem. This comes up for people. It's not really a student problem. This idea of, what do I want to do next, comes up at a variety of different stages in your life. Obviously, the going from high school to college, that's a big transition. From college to the real world, whatever the real world is for you, that's a big transition. We work inside corporations and stuff with, people in their kind of mid-career, mid-30s, mid-40s. Maybe the career's going great, they just want to accelerate it. Maybe the career isn't really the one, it's not really working out and they want to pivot. So they need some tools to make a change. And then nowadays, the one thing that's happening is people are living longer. And so when they retire, they have a much longer period of time that they'll be, quote, retired or not working in their in their first career, first or second career. And there's a big movement now that people call the encore career movement, where people are trying to move from the money-making side of their life to the meaning-making side. It's like, hey, I made a bunch of money, I'm fine, I can retire. But now I'm not going to sit on my butt and golf for the next 30 years, right? I mean, I'm alive, I'm vital, I have all these experiences and resources. I want to do something important in the world. And it's probably the first time for many people where they can make that decision without having to overlay, and can I make enough money, you know, to live? So all of those places, all those little stages, there's a thing in sociology called stage theory or life stage theory. All of those places, you need some tools. And we just, you know, there aren't a lot of good tools out there for figuring this stuff out. And design is a great approach.
It's an awesome sort of angle to take that, because it's where you can really stop, you know, letting life happen to you, pause, mm-hmm. regroup, and then move forward with a plan and an action, which is awesome.
Yeah, you know, we say everything in the world is designed. If you look around you, I'm looking at the background. There's an oven, there's a stove, there's cabinets, there's things. I think you're in your kitchen. Yeah. All those things were designed by somebody. Maybe they were designed well, maybe they're designed poorly. But yeah, you could just stumble into the default next thing for you, and you know, good luck. You hope that works out, or you could be an agent in that. You could have a more you know, agency in it and design that future. And why not? I mean, why? There's an old expression in design, and originally I started as a product designer doing physical products. You know, and there's an old expression from the German past: form follows function. And that's true, but you know, one of the functions of the things we design is to be beautiful, is to be delightful, is to make our life better. So don't let the default reality of what happens next, you know, just be what you end up with. Design it and make it beautiful and better and more interesting.
Now, where and how did the framework sort of come together for that toolbox that you really do with the Life Design Lab?
Well, like a lot of things, we just sort of, you know, we prototyped our way into it. We have an expression here that you build to think. You build stuff and you try things and then you figure out what works. So we knew we had the design thinking process diagram, which is a 5-hexagon thing. It starts with empathy. Think about the people first. Don't think about the problem. Then redefine the problem. Ideate, have lots of ideas, then prototype and test, and you know, test and test and test all your ideas until you come up with something that really is delightful or beautiful or you know, expressive. So we had that framework, and then we knew that, you know, for that to work in a life design thing, you needed a couple other things. You needed to really kind of understand, well, who am I and what am I looking for? So we have these two very simple exercises in the book called Work View and Life View. What's your theory of work? Give me two paragraphs on your theory of work. Why do you work? What's work for? Two paragraphs on what's the meaning of, you know, the big picture, the meaning of life. Put those two things together, get them kind of coherently talking to one another, and call that your compass. So that tells you, okay, all the things I'm going to be doing, my design criteria will be evaluated by my worldview and my work view, or life view and world and work view. And so with that, you can kind of get started. And then the rest is very empirical. Dave and I like to say, you set the bar low, you know, pick a something simple to try it, have a success or a learning, because there's no failure in prototype, there's just learning. And then do another one. And eventually you build up this sense that, hey, I can do this design, I can make it work. So, you know, with just the design thinking framework, a couple of other ideas, we like to think that the foundation of all this stuff is, you know, some good practices in your life. You want to maybe journal or do something so that you have some reflection on how things are going. Because, you know, when people ask you, how's it going? people go, you know, I don't know. Yeah. I'm not really sure. I don't really have a way of figuring that out. And so just, we're not the meditation guys or the mindfulness guys. If that's your thing, that's great. But you need something where you reflect on, you know, how's it going, whether that's a journal or some other practice, that's great. And it's pretty, you know, our tools are pretty straightforward. There's nothing in the book that takes longer than 10 or 15 minutes to do. But it's surprising that people don't even take that much time, you know, to ask themselves some pretty important questions. And you don't want to, you know, we like to think of, you know, those practices and figuring out how you make good choices and stuff. That's your aerobic exercise, so that when the marathon comes or when the big sprint comes, you're not out of shape, right? You don't want to have a big life decision show up. You know, do I want to get married or not? Do we want to take the promotion and move to Beijing or not? Is it time for kids or not? I mean, those are the big questions, right, in life. You'd like to have some reserve of self-knowledge when those things come up, right? Just like you'd like to be in shape when it's time to run the marathon.
Absolutely. Now, with that, what would you say are some of those skills, like maybe the top three skills that are necessary so that you can exceed at those critical moments?
Well, you know, I hate self-help books, and I wanted this to be a design book, but our wonderful editor at Knopf, senior editor Vicki Wilson, said, no, we don't sell design books. We sell, you know, this is what we're going to do. And she was absolutely right. But, you know, my trouble with books that try to reduce things to some simple formula, three ways to, you know, find an epiphany, five ways to make your life perfect, is life is just
never that easy.
It's not that easy. It's a complicated, messy thing, like all designs are. But when forced to make this simpler, everybody says, you got to make it simpler. It kind of boils down to two of the mindsets of a designer. So there's five mindsets we talk about in the book: curiosity, reframing, mindful of process, bias to action, and radical collaboration. But the two that we really lean into, we really want to just get curious. Your curiosity about, like, what's next? What's interesting? Look at all the interesting things that are going on in the world. AI, robots, big data, you know, the mindfulness movement, all these interesting things. Get curious. Talk to people. Go out and have these prototype conversations with people. Little prototypes of things that, like, hey, I'm interested about that. I wonder if I was doing that, what would it be like? And you go find someone who's already doing it. And you just ask them for their story. So get curious and then go out and talk to people. And then the big one is really, you know, this bias action. Try something. The answer is not going to be found sitting at home thinking hard. The answer is going to be found by collaborating out in the world with people who are doing interesting things. And then you go do them and you have this prototype experience, this embodied experience of what would it be like if I did this? Well, let's go try a little, let's take a little taster. Let's try, again, set the bar low. Let's go hang out with those people and see what they do. There's a famous William Gibson quote. He's the science fiction writer. He said, the future's already here. It's just unevenly distributed, which I think is really cool.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like, let's say let's say I wanted to be a video blogger, or I wanted to have my own, you know, my own platform on the internet to talk about interesting things with people. Well, I've never done that before, but I just met you. I could call you up and say, hey, you know, you sound like a really interesting guy, and I've looked at your stuff. It's really kind of cool. Could I buy a coffee and maybe get 30 minutes of your time? Could you tell me the story of how you got this thing going? And that, by the way, that almost always works, because basically what I just said is, I think you're interesting. You probably think you're interesting. Would you mind telling me how interesting you are? And I'll buy the coffee, right?
Right.
So, but it's time travel, right? You are already the version of, you're a version of me. You just happen to be you, but you've already been doing this for a long time, and I've never done it. It's the same thing. I've never done nanotechnology before. Go find some people who are doing that. I've never done, you know, social media work before. Let's go find some people and talk to them, or let's go have an experience, because, you know, we're not just intellects. We are embodied human beings. Sometimes we feel things in our gut or our feelings about something, and that tells us a lot. And what we're trying to do is use the wisdom of our emotions and our logic to kind of, you know, sneak up on what might be next and give it a try before we jump all in.
Right. I think that ties perfectly into what you talk about when you say, like, a dysfunctional belief, or people don't, they have a belief that they can't do that. They can't go start a conversation. So can you go in a little bit more depth about how you reframe some of those beliefs?
Well, you know, it is interesting, and we've been doing with the book tour and stuff, going on about 16 different cities and talking to lots of people. Alumni Association here at Stanford very generously sent us all over the place. We do these little workshops with hundreds and hundreds of folks. people just get stuck. You know, I mean, we all get stuck. And I think the misunderstanding is that, oh, designers are so creative, they never get stuck. No, designers get stuck all the time because we basically decided to have a profession where we come in every day and we try to do something we've never done before. Oh, invent an iPhone. I don't even know what that is. What's an iPhone? Right. So, you know, but designers have all sorts of ways of getting unstuck. They have brainstorming and mind mapping and all these other things we talk about in the book. So people get stuck, and one of the things they get stuck on is, oh man, you know, I should have had this figured out by now. I'm 30, I'm 32, I'm whatever, I'm 28. I should have it figured out. And since I don't have it figured out, I'm late. And since I'm late, I'm screwed, and there's nothing I can do. That's total baloney. If you look at the psychology and the research of this period of time between about 20 and 35, we've known for 40 or 50 years that people do not fully emerge into their adult self until their mid-30s. They don't fully settle into the things that are their strengths and the way in which they express themselves in the world. So you're supposed to be confused between 20 and 35. It's totally normal, right? And so, but when if you think you're late, then you're stuck, and then you get all this anxiety. That's a big one. The other one was like, there's one best version of my life, and if I don't figure it out, you know, I've settled for something less. By the way, we're pretty research-based. I mean, we teach at Stanford. You can't just make stuff up. This isn't politics. This is psychology. So we draw a lot on, you know, the design thinking stuff, but also a lot on the work of the positive psychology movement. Guys like Martin Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi and Dan Goleman, the emotional intelligence guy. We've known also for years that nowadays in a modern career, you're probably going to have two or three different completely different money-making careers before you retire. You know, I was an engineer, then I was an entrepreneur, and now I'm an academic. I mean, they're going to have completely different careers. So you're not late, and there's no one best version of you. You're going to have lots of versions of you. And when people try to optimize this unavailable best thing, they just get all wrapped around an axle, and then they get stuck again. And so these reframes are just ways of getting you out of a no-win situation. We have a thing in the book we call a gravity problem. A gravity problem is like, oh man, you know, I'm doing pretty good. I'm making a lot of money, but I really want to be a poet. But I only want to be a poet if I can make, you know, maybe six figures, seven figures. Well, I'm sorry. In our culture, poets don't make seven figures. Well, I mean, unless they're rappers, I guess. if you're Jay-Z, I guess you're a poet and you're making seven figures. So it's just get over it. It's like, accept that that's not the way it works. If you want to have a side hustle as a poet, there's plenty of open mic nights. There's plenty of places you can publish. Self-publishing has never been easier. Or don't anchor. Another thing is the anchor problem. Like, well, I really want to fly airplanes every weekend, but I can't afford a plane. So how do I afford a plane? You know, it's like, well, that's just a solution masquerading as a problem. There's a lot of ways to fly on the weekends. You can have flying clubs. You can, you know, hang out at the airports, and you know, and there's all sorts of other ways you can express that need. But people sometimes they pick an impossible solution or they pick an impossible problem. And in some ways, I think it's just because we're sometimes afraid to move forward, and sometimes it's easier to have a problem than to actually do something about it.
Yeah.
You know, my friend, my co-author, my good friend Dave says, you can't solve a problem you're not willing to have. You know, lots of people, I mean, I'm sure you have friends who complain all the time about their job or their partner or their something, but they never do anything. So the first step in our process is accept. Am I going to work on this? Yes. Do I want to have a positive outcome? Yes, I do. Okay, now how do I break it into small steps, you know, set the bar low and start moving? That bias to action, fueled by your curiosity, is really the sort of secret to the whole process.
Yep, and I think, like you said, that designer aspect of knowing that it's okay to try different things and fail and go through that loop again and again to figure it out. Well,
you know, look at any piece of design. If you look at any design history, there's a nice piece on the invention of the mouse. If you go over to IDEO, where they worked on the very first mouse for the first Macintosh, they'll show you a cabinet with about 300 prototypes in it. Are all the prototypes failures and only the last one is the good one? No, that's how you build your way to a brand new solution. Is you build lots and lots of prototypes that quote fail because they don't solve the problem perfectly, but you just keep going and going and going until you make it better. So why would you do the same thing with your life? I mean, you know, if you, you know, do I want to do this or do that? Well, you know, I don't get to choose two things and do them both in parallel and see which comes out best. So, you know, you gotta have a bias to action. You gotta pick things, and you gotta have a method for discovering whether it's more or less the right choice, I guess. And that's where, you know, prototyping and testing and having a good internal compass really helps you make good choices.
Now, for you, for when you were starting this, I know it's a bit of a risk and you're figuring out something new. And so how did you really know when it was going to be successful, or do you consider it successful for your life design lab now that it's catching on?
Well, you know, one of the nice design, again, if you think about design from the point of view of, I worked at Apple and we have a fantastic studio there, and they make objects that are just incredibly beautiful. And one of the hardest problems in design as a craft is aesthetics. How do you know when something is beautiful or is done? So that's tough. But in human-centered design, it's actually kind of easy because we just follow the students. Dave and I, like I said, we prototyped about three or four quick exercises, none of which we use anymore. They've all been improved. And we got six students in a room, and they refused to leave because they were so engaged in the process. Then we did 20 students, and they told all their friends. And the next time we were trying to, you know, enroll a class, 100 people tried to sign up for 20 spots. And so we just kept following with our own curiosity. Where's the energy from the students? What's the problem that they're all wrestling with? And one of the problems is identity. One of the problems is, what do I do when I get out of school? I've only ever been a student. I don't know. Like, what's life like? So it was pretty straightforward. If you use our process and you start with empathy and you really try to understand where are the issues and how can we create little, you know, exercises, worksheets, something that will help kind of open up the issue and get you some forward motion. So in human-centered design, you know you're on the right track. Like when the customer won't give you the prototype back. In physical design, when I was a toy designer, we would build toys, mock-ups of toys, and we would send them off to the testing group, and they would test with kids. Kids would come in and play with the toys. You knew you had a hit if the model came back broken, because that meant the kids were engaged in playing so much, you know, so hard that they broke it. The models themselves are kind of fragile compared to the real thing. And if the model came back and it was still in pretty good shape, you knew it was a dud. The kids didn't like it. It's the same thing in life design. When you try something and there's no energy there, you know, you had three information interviews, three prototype conversations, and nothing resonated. It didn't sound like that was very fun, or that what the person was doing was something that you would be interested in. That's great data.
Yeah. I mean,
that's not the path probably. But if you come back after two or three of those conversations, or you go have an experience, you go to a meetup or something and hang out with a bunch of people doing that thing that you might be interested in, and you come back and your body's energized and you can't wait to, you know, write a post about it or write something in your journal, and five more ideas pop into your head of other things you want to try, then you know, because you're following that energy and you're following that curiosity. That's how you know you're on the right track. That's how we design the class. That's how I design products. You follow the people.
And then, like you said at the beginning, you know, it started snowballing and rolling downhill. And tell me about how you took it from the university sphere to the public sphere with the book and
you know. Yeah, well, and actually on the university side, just real quick, we just finished about a month ago what we're calling the transfer program. A lot of other schools have said, hey, we're interested in this sort of life formation stuff, and you guys seem to have an interesting approach. Tell us more. So we just had a event where we had 14 schools. We had about 35 apply, but 14 schools came to Stanford, and we ran a four-day boot camp where we taught them how to teach the class. And this was Harvard, Yale, MIT, Dartmouth, Berkeley, a couple of Cal State, state schools, really different populations of students. And they're all going to start teaching the class. So after we knew we had something that was useful and the student evaluations were coming back strongly and the research we were doing was saying, yeah, this actually works. We had two PhD students study the class to see if the efficacy of our intervention, is the way they talk about it, was successful or statistically useful, and it turns out it was it builds self-efficacy. It lowers dysfunctional beliefs. It raises your ability to have new ideas. It lowers your anxiety about your future. So we have statistical evidence that all that's true. So we were like, okay, now we know we had a product that works. And now we need to give it to, now we need to give it away, essentially. One way we're doing that is by running these workshops now and teaching other schools how to teach the curriculum. And it's all free, and they just get all of our, we have hundreds of slide decks and lots of research. And we just give it to them, and they'll customize it for the Harvard audience or for the Cal State, Livermore audience. And then the other thing was like, well, you know, and then one way people hear about this stuff is they read about it. Right. And we've been pestered for a while from some people saying, hey, you should write a book. That's what professors do. And we finally sat down and did that, and ended up getting a great agent who found us a fantastic publisher. Vicki Wilson is our editor, and Knopf is the publisher, and it's just been amazing. Everybody said, oh, you know, you're not going to get a good deal. You're not going to get it. It's sort of a self-help thing. It's design. Nobody knows who you are. You're not Malcolm Gladwell, it's like, and none of that turned out to be true. Everybody really liked the book proposal. We had lots of interest in it. We're super happy with the folks at Knopf and their support of the book. So it was just really the idea of, okay, how else can we get this out in the world so that people who don't have the opportunity, I mean, Stanford is not a very big school. We only have 6,500 undergraduates. Mm-hmm. And about 10,000 graduate students. So, total the population of students here is about 16 or 17,000 students. I mean, Berkeley is 30 or 40,000. Ohio State is 60 or 70.
Yeah, that's where I went.
Yeah, I mean, we're a tiny school in the scheme of things. And all the elite colleges, the Harvards and the Yales and the MITs, we hang out with. It's great, but, the Cal State system, the California State, university system, not the University of Berkeley and those things, but the Cal State system of community colleges is 400,000 kids. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to have, I'd love to have the opportunity to help those folks, same issues, same problems, just, slightly different framing, slightly different economics maybe, but they want to design a life. They want to get things organized. They want to be happy. They need some tools. So the idea was, in the university side, give it away as much as possible so other people can teach it. The book was another method of getting it out just to the world. We're now in 7 or 8 languages. The Chinese version's coming out soon. The Taiwan version, the simplified Chinese and traditional Chinese. We're in Brazil. We're in Germany and Australia. Well, Australia's English, but we're in Holland. I just got the cover. We just approved the cover for Croatia.
Wow!
People in Croatia want to read "Designing Your Life," but it'll be there. So it's just been the idea of, hey, if it's useful, let's get it off campus and get it to as many people as we can.
That's really exceptional. Now, a couple questions on you in particular. So, as you've been doing this, did you have any inspirations of people that inspired you? I should say.
There's lots of people who've been sort of role models or inspirations, along the way. When I first came to Stanford, I thought I would be a physicist. No other reason than, as most high school kids, my physics teacher liked me. So I thought maybe, I wanted to be a physicist. It's funny, I do a lot of advising, here at Stanford, and freshmen come and they say, oh, I want to do this and I want to do that. And when you actually ask them why, they don't know. And I didn't know. I just thought that was cool. But I got this amazing advisor, Dr. Richard Taylor. He's the guy who got the Nobel Prize for discovering the quark. And he was fantastic advisor. And after about a year, he and I both concluded I was probably not a physicist. But I liked art. And I like painting. I still paint and draw and stuff. And so I thought, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll just put art and physics together and then I'll be perfect, and I'll declare my own major. And I went to do that, and the woman who ran the department at the time, Kay Bradley, said, oh, you don't have to do that. That's a thing called product design. Just go over and talk to this guy named Bob McKim. And so I met Bob McKim, who put this program together at Stanford, this very unusual, very, very futuristic program in the 70s. And he was a fantastic mentor. He was himself a designer. He was a successful entrepreneur. He was a great professor. And he really kind of created the methodology that we live in. So Bob was one of my first role models. The very first guy I ever worked for, a guy named Howard Bollinger at Kenner Toys, when Kenner was still an independent company, was just my model of the most creative, most inspiring, most interesting kind of a manager. I don't think I've ever had one as good. It was kind of funny to have it for your first time. He was a great inspiration of how do you work and get the job done, but keep yourself creative and, you know, happy and vital and fun. It'd be interesting, you know, he was the vice president of new product development and back in Cincinnati in those days, everybody wore suits and ties to work and we were all very formal. And Howard would be in this very nice, you know, Italian suit with a good tie, and he'd be on the ground like a little kid playing with trucks and Play-Doh and making, you know, truck noises and smashing the Play-Doh and crashing the trucks. And it was like, hey, if he can do that in a suit, you know, anything. So, you know, I've had really amazing experiences working with lots of fun people. Right now, I got this job because David Kelly invented it essentially for me, and he's been a fantastic person to work with, truly an inspirational guy. David is, probably one of the most, one of the most fun people I've had an opportunity to work with, and I'm very privileged to have, you know, an opportunity to be at Stanford. I don't have a PhD. I didn't do any of the academic things you're supposed to do. I just mostly focus on the kids and the students and how to make a great experience for them, and David is totally aligned to that. So, those are, you know, very direct influences in my life.
That's incredible. I really like how the whole system with the life design process is backed up by statistical analysis, and it's not stuff pulled out of left field. And you know, you've taken this inspiration and you went out into the world and proved it, and now you're sharing it, which is truly something special.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, one of the reasons, you know, I don't mean to dismiss the whole self-help category of books. I'm sure there are many books that are very powerful and useful for people. But what I found when I look at a lot of those things is they're kind of based on very little evidence. Mm-hmm. Maybe based on personal experience, which is fine. But my experience of my life and yours is probably quite different. And so to generalize from what worked for me to what I think is going to work for you doesn't seem, you know, that's. I don't know if that's valid. So we've been very careful to try to find good research to base the exercises and things we come up with, and then we modify them, you know, according to how the students respond. You know, the class is a 10-week class and it's a 2-hour studio essentially, and it's not really a class because there's no lecturing. Everybody's sitting in groups of six. There might be 10 groups of six, but to you, you're in a little seminar of six people and there's two guys talking. That's the group of six shares all of their plans together. They share their assignments together. We have them write poems. It's really quite wonderful. But the class isn't, you know, there's very little lecturing. It's a lot of activities. There's six or seven different things in every 2-hour segment. So if you look at the whole class, it's about 40 different experiences, and we don't even when we prep an hour before and we debrief an hour after. When we're prepping the class, it's more like event management. Here's the five things that are going to happen. Here's when we all get out of, everybody gets out of their chairs and builds something. Here's when everybody goes and does this other stuff. Boom, boom, boom. So it's a really tightly choreographed experience. But in that 30 or 40 exercises, every one of them has been prototyped a dozen times. And I got terabytes full of old decks of stuff we don't use anymore because, one, we're always trying to improve it. If we can find a better model, we do it. If we find better research, we use it. Mm-hmm. Even in the 7 years we've been teaching, the students have really changed. You know, this isn't the millennials anymore. This is right. Generation Z or whatever it is. Their attitudes are different. Their pain points are different. The things they care about are different. So we're constantly trying to keep ahead of that.
Very nice. And now if someone wants to find out a bit more about this or find the book, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, we have a website, www.designingyour.life. So designing your and then .life, no com or a word or anything. And that's where we post all of the worksheets from the book. You can just download those for nothing. We post videos and stuff we've done. We also have a Facebook page, Designing Your Life, the book. And we do Facebook Live events. Dave and I will do open office hours, maybe every other Friday the summer it might be a little less, but we're doing every other Friday, and we just take questions from the community, people who are reading the book and have questions. And sometimes we'll do a little piece of content on one of the exercises, how to make it better or more interesting. We're tracking about, we suggest in the book, hey, life design is fun, but you should do it with a design team. Don't do it by yourself. And we're tracking probably over 400 book clubs, life design teams that are going through the book together. And they're all up on a Facebook page and sharing, you know, their experiences back and forth. And that's really fun. So just sort of having a chance to listen in to everybody else's journey has been fun. I mean, we get to do it in class, obviously, one-on-one. But at the scale, the book is now in its 10th printing. It's doing very well. It's still, you know, popping around in the Amazon, you know, ratings in 200 or 300 or 400, you know, best books on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So we just keep trying to help people find resources. So I'd say the webpage and then the Facebook page are the two places to go. We're doing an in-person workshop. I'm going to be teaching 2 one-day workshops in San Francisco here, one on August 5th and one on August 26th. You can find that on our website as well. That's you know, you pay some money and you come do the book with me kind of thing. We don't do a lot of teaching outside of Stanford just because it takes a lot of time, and we're mostly trying to figure out how to scale this. I mean, I can teach a workshop for 30 or 40 people, and that's great, but that's only 30 or 40 people. And, you know, maybe if we get on Facebook, we can get 1,000 people or something like that. So that's why we talk to folks like you to try to get the message out and have people see if they can find some resources that are useful. We, you know, we say in the beginning of the book, like, this is just a bunch of ideas which might be useful, you know, and these reframes and things which give you new opportunities for solutions. And then we're going to give you some tools. So it's ideas and tools. There's no... It's not a 1-2-3 method. It's, you can start anywhere in the book. If you're looking for a job and you're frustrated, read the chapter on how not to find a job, because I guarantee you, you're doing things that are never going to work. And you just need to know that so you can change strategies, right? Or if you're, you know, at a big crossroads in your life, just do the work view and life view exercise and see if that breaks things free. You don't need to read the book in order. It's kind of fun because we added some stories. There's a story of a millennial and a story of a 30-something person and a story of a 50-something person. You can kind of follow them through the book. And we use other examples as well. But you just, you know, it's a resource and it's a set of tools.
Absolutely. So I will definitely add the link to that down there in the bottom, because I think it's, like you said, it's something that everyone, no matter what stage of their life, can find value in it, which is what I think is the key.
Yeah. I mean, we've done these workshops everywhere. And the very first workshop we did in New York for the Alumni Association in New York, they had about 300 people in a ballroom in the Marriott right off of Times Square. And sitting right in the front was a woman from the class of 1950. She was 85 years old. And when we got to the part about planning three lives, your three Odyssey plans, she raised her hand and Dave went over figuring, well, she's 85. She doesn't have any plans. And she's like, look, I've got 6 or 7 things I want to do next. I got this and this and this and this and this. This piece of paper only has 3 plans on it. I need more paper. And, you know, if you're 85 and you got more things on your plate than you know how to get to, you're living a good life.
Absolutely.
And we haven't met anybody at any age, at any stage of their life, even people who, you know, are having some stress or some stuff going on that's not fun. Everybody thinks the next part of their life is useful. It's going to be useful, or it's going to be important. Everybody wants to plan what's coming next, or at least have some idea about how to impact what's coming next. I mean, we've never met anybody who doesn't think the rest of their life is going to be interesting, worth it. And you know, we are not therapists. We do not do anything. We assume healthy people trying to figure out, you know, how to have healthy lives. If you have depression, and I certainly understand, you know, the importance and the seriousness of that, or you have other things that really are preventing you from taking a healthy approach to what comes next, you got to go find, you know, real life doctors and helpers for that kind of stuff, because that's serious. But for the folks that we're working with, you know, and we're very clear in class, and every once in a while in class we'll run into a student who really is struggling with some, you know, medical issue. Mm-hmm. And we immediately, you know, extract them and send them over to, you know, we got great resources here at Stanford for helping kids that are stressed. Because you can't do, you know, design is a pretty neutral, you know, value system. But the one thing in design is you never design something to make it worse. You always design something to make it better. It's an inherently optimistic point of view. Now, I've been on some teams where the thing we designed was actually worse. We weren't trying to do that. That was a process mistake. Or it was just bad manufacturing or something. But the goal is, you know, to take some small steps and make things better.
Wonderful. Two last questions for you here. If you could have a conversation with anyone, past, present, or future, and share your dream with them, what would it be? Or who would it be, I should say?
Who would it be? I'm a vast fan and a rereader of all of Hemingway's work. I would love to sit down at a bar with Hemingway and have a margarita and, you know, and talk to him about his 6-word story. I've had a chance to be in the room a couple of times with the Dalai Lama. And not like a personal meeting or anything, mm-hmm. but just like he came to Stanford, he came to UCSF. I was able to be there and see him and be, you know, close enough to actually see the guy. I myself am an atheist. I don't believe he's the reincarnation of anything, but that's his story. Then that's fine with me. There's something different about that guy.
There's a presence.
There's a presence or a something about it. So it'd be really interesting to sit down and talk to him. And by the way, our agent, Doug Abrams, is the guy who wrote the Book of Joy with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And that came about solely because Doug suggested it. He said, wouldn't it be cool if we got the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu together and they talked about something that they really cared about? And he pulled that off, and he spent 2 weeks in Dharamsala just recording everything they said as he asked them questions. And the Book of Joy has been, you know, on the New York Times bestseller list for 20 weeks or whatever it's been. So he's actually been able to sit in a room and have my dream come true.
Very nice. And last and final, is there anything that you wish I had asked or any final wisdom that you'd like to share?
Well, I don't know that I have wisdom, but the wisdom is for guys like the Dalai Lama. The one thing that I want to share is I really want to come back to this notion of, it's scary to make change. Everybody's afraid of change. Everybody wants to, you know, have things just stay the same and be okay. And then sometimes when they hear about our book, they think, oh, okay, I'm going to totally change my life. I am going to go from being the CEO to the poet, and it's all going to work out. You know, I just got to find my passion. There's no evidence, by the way, the psychology of passion and stuff, we can go on a long conversation, but essentially 8 out of 10 people don't have a passion and never will. And it's not an organizing principle for life that's very good. If you have one, great. But if you're one of the 8 of 10, yes, stop with the passion thing, that's not going to get you anywhere. But we really do like to push the idea of, you know, you're going to do 3 plans. You're going to come up, you have empathy for the world. You're going to have empathy for yourself. It is possible to make big change, but that's not our objective. Our objective is simply to say, you know, like I said, get curious about something. Talk to people and try stuff. Get curious, talk to people and try stuff. Take small steps. Be available to the things in the world that will show up as soon as you start intentionally designing the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Magical stuff happens, amazing stuff happens. People do, in fact, change their lives. But mostly what they do is they just make the life they're in better. Mm-hmm. Because they just spend more time and attention on what's working. And so this isn't a method for radically changing your life. It's just a method for living the tagline of the book is a well-lived, joyful life. We want more joy in our world. We want more connection in our world. A lot of times people will do the 3 Odyssey plans, and then they'll come back and they'll say, you know what? I actually kind of like my life. It's going pretty good. Now that I've done 3 plans and I've looked at, you know, all the other things I could do, what I'm doing is pretty good. Although there is this one thing I want to add back in, or this thing that was in my wild card that, you know, I'm not willing to let that go. So again, it's like, get curious, talk to people, try stuff, take small steps. Don't go all in, because it's too hard. Then you could actually end up in a place where there's a failure. You know, just because you want to do something doesn't mean the world's going to pay you to do it.
Right. Yeah.
No, this is serious, and you should take it seriously, but it's also a lot of fun. So, you know, take small steps it's almost never necessary, you know, to sort of throw everything away and start over.
Wonderful. Yeah. I think you've shared some incredible wisdom. I'm definitely intrigued by the process, and the book is on the short list of my Amazon list after all these interviews we've done. So I am definitely going to check it out, recommend it, add all the links, and share it with the world, because this is what we do. I really appreciate your time. I hope that you've enjoyed, and I know I've definitely learned a few things. Our audience will definitely learn quite a bit, and I thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thanks. Thanks for your time.
And that's all. What'd you think? Let me know the favorite thing that you learned in the comments below. And if you know someone who could use a bit of inspiration, be a pal and send them the link to this video. I know that they will most certainly appreciate it. And I have included links to Bill's website, books, all the information and more. So if there's something that we discussed and you want to find out a bit more about it, go ahead and make sure you read and click on the links in the description below. As always, click subscribe right down there in the corner so that you never miss a video. Every Wednesday, we're releasing our new expert series with influencers and top performers so that you can learn the very best tips right from the source. Don't miss open enrollment on our brand new course, Millennial Magnetism. Click the link in the description below for more details and how you can unleash your inner awesome. Until next time, ciao for now.